This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning, I'm Azif Azuddin.
And I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It. Now we're winding down 2015 to its last few days, and it's been a hell of a rollercoaster of a year, media-wise anyway. Now our producers Cheryl Kaur and Hanif Bahruddin are in the studio with us this morning as we look back at our top 5 favourite stories that we've done in this year. Welcome, both of you.
Hi.
Hello.
So this year we had 5 stories which we did, and I think the selection is a pretty interesting one. Let's start off with the first one. Aisha, what do you think of the list?
The list of stories we've chosen is a healthy mix of investigative journalism, MH370, and also Merdeka stories. So the first story we've picked for you guys today is called Heist of the Century, and it's about 1MDB and the series of exposés that Sarawak Report has done. So 1MDB is probably the most talked about story this year, and it's been making headlines everywhere because the 1MDB issue first captured our interest when it racked up 42 billion ringgit in debt and even caused several publications like The Edge and Sarawak Report to be suspended.
Now, The Edge and Sarawak Report were reporting on it religiously. As a result of this, The Edge was suspended for 3 months and the Sarawak Report's website, their access was blocked. The Edge seemed to have reported on the technical aspects or the facts on 1MDB, while the Sarawak Report provided the so what to help readers understand how it directly affects them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I guess we need to kind of know how and why Sarawak Report's Heist of the Century article became viral in the first place, right? I think prior to that, a few weeks before the article itself came out on the website, The New York Times released an expose talking about how the Prime Minister's stepson allegedly acquired money from many different sources, unseen ones, to purchase property in New York, but also fund the movie, his movie, in fact.
The Wolf of Wall Street,
exactly,
starring Leonardo DiCaprio, yeah. Right?
Yeah. And I think just right after that, a few weeks after that, was when Claire Rucastle-Brown, which is the editor of the Sarawak Report, came up with this very sensational, in fact, it can be said to be sensational, but also very intriguing report, just accounting for the email exchanges between the people involving 1MDB and allegedly Petro Saudi, who was said to be, you know, in the cahoots with 1MDB as well.
Yeah, it's a very lengthy story, and it's also very, it was put together in a very narrative form. So it follows a trail of emails and how the story unfolds, right?
Mm-hmm. So I think why people are interested in it, because it started out as a sovereign wealth fund. It started out as a fund called Terengganu Investment Authority, which then became 1MDB. But as a sovereign wealth fund like Khazanah National, they use our tax money to invest in properties. So 42 billion ringgit in debt, that's practically, you're spending our money and we don't even know where it went.
And you're in debt as well. So people want accountability. And the problem was that there was no accountability at the time. So that's when The Edge and Sarawak Report kind of saw the gap and tried to fill it.
Yeah, it's interesting how they cover the story, right? The Edge takes a very sober approach, a very analytical and statistical approach to the story, bringing out facts and figures, whereas Sarawak Report did a very tabloid-like story where they told all these sensational stories about the people involved in the whole debacle, right?
And I guess then you get to reach two different types of audiences. You get to reach the business audience who wants the technical terms, who wants the facts and figures. And then you also reach the people who, let's say, don't really understand the facts and figures and want the so what? Why should I worry about this? How does this affect me?
So as if you spoke to the chief editor and journalist of the Sarawak Report, Claire Rucastle-Brown herself. So walk us through the episode.
Okay, well, because it's considered an investigative piece, I, of course, inquired her about that, right? I mean, where did she get the emails to begin with? What even prompted her to even start into investigating 1MDB? And for her, because Sarawak Report is primarily about Sarawak, prior to this, her efforts was about uncovering Tahir Mahmud's administration and the things which is happening in his state, right? But leading there, she found links to former Chief Minister Tahir Mahmud to 1MDB and to Prime Minister Najib at that. So that started off an unraveling of 1MDB, how big the issue was, the key players, the people involved, how much money, and the emails, of course, as we know now, which were revealed by Justo, which is in custody up there in Thailand right now. So all it began was actually just a simple inquiry of wanting to know where the link started. Yeah, and for me, I think the biggest question was, where did she get these emails? And was it at one point of time, people were accusing her of fabricating these thousands of emails? And this was the question I posed to her.
Very recently, PetroSaudi's come up with a claim that Sarawak Report's emails that surfaced is a fabrication. And in fact, they've enlisted the Scotland Yard to help them, and they're accusing Sarawak Report of hacking. Now, what would your response to that be?
Well, there's a certain contradiction within your own question, isn't it? Am I a master forger who's been fabricating thousands of emails, or am I a hacker who has acquired thousands of genuine emails? PetroSaudi needs to decide which they're accusing me of, because they contradict each other. The truth is, I am neither. I neither hacked these emails, nor did I forge them.
Now, the thing that this brings is the question of journalistic ethics, and we've done a story on this previously. Now, Javier Justo, he's formerly a PetroSaudi staff who leaked the emails in exchange for money. It brings the question, does the end justify the means? So what do you guys think?
Well, I think this is a very touchy issue, because if you look at the 1MDB expose earlier this year, it has changed the way we view national politics. It has even changed how we view the Najib administration. And yes, while Putrajaya is saying that this is an attempt to oust Prime Minister Najib, for me, the biggest step is in investigative journalism. Do we have, or are we allowed to go to the lengths of allegedly at least paying money in order to get information? Should we do that?
But technicalities can be argued here as to whether money was exchanged or not. Yes, money was promised to Justo, and there is no proof thus far that money did exchange hands and therefore was a crime committed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it brings about the question of ethics as to how you actually gain information from others, right? I mean, it's for a bigger cause. You can probably argue that, but is it ethical? Is it not? It's something that I think we need to always ponder, especially when it comes to journalists, right?
Would you guys pay for sources?
I wouldn't. I mean, at the end of the day, if you use deception in order to get information, you lose the very moral high ground that you stand on in order to serve the public.
Exactly.
And in order to serve the public, you need to come from a moral place where you can say that I've acquired this information fairly. I've acquired this information with my best possible sources. But yes, you can argue that in the case of 1MDB, if deception was not used, maybe you wouldn't even have known about it at all.
That was the main issue for me as well. It's this question of what if deception wasn't used and therefore the information would not have been found out. So you go through the whole, is it fair? Is it just? And I guess...
Is it in public interest?
In public interest as well. So this brings us to a story that we did a few months ago, which was the undercover no-go or a go-go, where we explore the ethics of going undercover. So if you're interested in undercover journalism and the ethics behind it, do listen to that episode.
Which brings us to our second story, which still runs in the theme of investigative journalism. And I think one which we all personally enjoyed listening to. We call it Death Camp for Migrants. Anyway, this story is about migration. As you can see, earlier this year, there were issues of migration. Rohingyas from Myanmar, the Rakhine State. There was also Syrians moving out of the country and to Europe and even some parts of Malaysia, right? So Germany alone has seen about 600,000 refugees enter its country. And this is the most since the end of World War II.
And even this year, you can see our own Malaysian authorities turn away Rohingya boat people, and it's causing so much outrage and controversy from the public. And who can forget Island Kurdi, the boy whose boat capsized and his body was washed ashore, and it caused an international outrage. What are we going to do about these refugees?
Mm-hmm. And it became the most viral photograph this year. The picture of a boy lying head down on the sand by the shore. How is that not a heartbreaking image?
Amidst all that, there's also the discovery of the mass graves in Wang Kalian, which
it
is the focus.
Came hand in hand, yeah.
And which is the focus of our story for this particular episode, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And so do you remember how we basically gathered all the Malay Mail newspapers and put them together on the desk? And we were looking through it and all that. And I think that's one of my fondest memories of working in a team with you guys. Just going through the Malay Mail headlines and the migrant coverage, the photographs of the migrant camps up north and all. Now, Aisha, you spoke to S. Arul Das from the Malay Mail. What did you get from that?
Well, we've concluded that he was the first reporter in Malaysia to find out about the Wang Kalian deaths. And it started, obviously, with a clue. So previously, before they discovered the death camp at Wang Kalian, he noticed there was a surge in bodies popping up in Penang.
I'm personally from Penang and this happened on the mainland. And I know a lot of my family members were thinking, oh no, this community fights are going on. It's going to spill over, blah, blah, blah. But the police then came out to say that, no, hang on, there are no community conflicts going on or whatever it is. But it never really answered the question as to why it is these body parts were popping up.
Mm-hmm. And I think as any good investigative journalist would start his trail, would be to question, where did this all come from? Where did the body start popping? And I think this is what eventually led Arudas to the migrant camps up in the north.
So he followed the trail which led him to the Thailand borders, the borders between Thailand and Perlis. And did you guys know that we have a gate there? But then some parts of the border are gated, but some parts you can just walk through. Just walk through just like that. So with this lack of security, the issue, the idea of human trafficking crossing to our borders became clearer. The evidence was there. So he got a contact from Thailand and he told his editors, okay, I'm going to follow this story. And his editors were really worried that, you know, because you are reporting on human trafficking, ruthless human traffickers. So he drove.
And on top of that, he's quite an old
yeah,
fella.
He's 68 and his journey is insane. I don't even know I can make that journey. So what he did was he drove up to Perlis, the forest, and he parked his car and he trekked up the hill. He trekked up where the death camps were and he was trekking. And when he finally got to the camps, he saw graves and freshly dug soil and camps with huge huts that can house at least 1,000 people.
Yeah, and the most gripping of his experience climbing the hills was actually what he noticed there. And we have a clip of him describing his experience there.
We went to the foothills, parked my car and started walking. After half an hour, I exhausted. I said I cannot walk any further. The steep hill was about 200 meters. But the guys who came with me, they're all young. I'm quite old. Okay, I'm 60 actually. But they helped me. One of the guys pushed me from behind to go up. I crawl. And then I hold the roots to go up. And there was once I lie down on the ground. I say I cannot make it anymore. But they didn't give up. They waited for a while. After walking for more than about 1.5 hours to 2 hours, I reached the place. I was shocked. I was shocked to see, I can't believe, in the middle of a jungle, and on the top of a hill, it's heartbreaking for me to see that the graves. First thought to me was, the people could have died due to the hiking on the hill. That will kill them. If it is they are old, they are sick, definitely will die on the way to the camp. From there, we came down, we walked up another higher ground, about 200 meters or 300 meters, we saw a huge camp. It's more than 15 huts, shelters. And one of the shelters easily can accommodate 1,000 people. And there were special shelters for women to sleep. And I saw a lot of medicines. And the graves I earlier we saw is also freshly dug soil there. It's not very long.
This is one of my greatest fears as a journalist, you know, seeing dead bodies and separating emotions and my work. Because if you guys remember the spread on all the papers, not just Malay Mail, there were skulls and graves, and even some graves had 3 to 4 bodies in them.
It I know very gruesome. Yeah,
so I know investigative journalism is part of our job scope, but still, I don't know if I have enough heart to report on things like that. What do you guys think?
I won't limit it to just investigative journalism being about discovering the gruesome, right? So also, I think if we link it back to our earlier topic about 1MDB, I think it's just discovering things which shock you, things which just break with what you understand about the world, what you thought the world or structures were. It's like doing a thesis, I guess you could say it like that. You start with a question, you start with an assumption, and then suddenly, in following this whole trail, and this I think is the best part of investigative journalism, is that you end up somewhere different. You end up with a different set of questions. Questions lead to more questions. And at the end of the day, where you end up is really just far away from where you even began, but all the pieces fall well.
Exactly. It's just like this web of questions, and every time you answer one question, another question pops up. And I think this makes this story very, very interesting.
So far, we've talked about investigative journalism through the lens of the 1MDB expose, as well as the uncovering of the migrant camps up in the north. Now, after the break, we'll come back and talk about MH370 a year on, about how we use the word terrorist in the media, as well as commemorating Merdeka this year. All that in a minute, right after the break. This is In Case You Missed It, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is In Case You Missed It. I'm Azif Azuddin, and joining me in the studio is my co-host,
Aisha Tajuddin, hello.
And our producers,
Cheryl Kaur
and Hanif Baharuddin.
Right, so this week we'll be taking a look back at our episodes that we've done this year in 2015. And if you followed us since earlier, we've been talking about investigative journalism, namely the 1MDB expose and the migrant camps in the north. Now, we're going to continue with three more stories. Let's start.
Let's start with the MH370 Flying Through Crisis episode. Now, it's been a year since the disappearance of MH370, and up to this point, there is still no closure for the families, and we've been following a lot of false leads. The disappearance still remains a mystery. Now, Azif, you worked on this story. What was the focus of this story?
I think the idea behind doing this story basically is just to commemorate the year-long disappearance. For me, it was more important, especially because it's a media show. It first started with exploring how the media reported on it. And I think we saw a lot of cases of conspiracy theories, a lot of frustrations, misinformation. But then I found this one former journalist, M. Krishnamurti, who wrote this one book called MH370 Flying Through Crisis. And I thought it was interesting because what he did was examine how Putrajaya and the MAS authorities delved the issue through their press conferences, through communication and crisis management. And at the end of the day, I thought, hey, why not get Jahar Basadi, the chief editor of the Malaysian Insider, in the room as well to talk about the media side of things. So how was things on the side of the media in reporting this issue where information is key, but yet you are lacking the proper relationship to get information from? So for me, at the end of the day, the MH370, this episode was about the relationship between the government, authorities and the media.
And I think you also explored the way in which media covered MH370, right? Especially from the perspective of not only local media, but how international media covered the story as well.
Exactly. How CNN came out with conspiracy theories, how China media even viewed us negatively because of how we handled the issue, right?
Do you guys remember this? CNN talks about the Bermuda Triangle conspiracy theory, the black hole conspiracy theory. Is CNN. This tragedy put us in the international spotlight. And like to quote Dato' Sri Shamuddin Hussein, it was an unprecedented event.
I can't hear the word unprecedented or corroborated for a while now.
And it pushed us into the international limelight. So we not just have to deal with this on our own. We also have everybody looking at us. What's our next move? What are our operating procedures?
Now, I was on the ground when this happened, and on the first day and days leading up, days after as well. And it was surreal seeing all the different media organizations coming in. On the first day itself, there were not many international media organizations, I would say. Then, after a while, once the story picked up momentum and once people, you know, started to pay attention, you could see tons of international media coming in, and the room was packed. On the first day, it was, I think, not really that many journalists in the room. But by the end of that first week, it was insane, the amount of journalists, international journalists that were packed up there.
And if I'm not mistaken, the MH370 press conferences continued for the next 5 months, if I'm not mistaken. But each press conference was met with pretty much a repeat of the same information.
That was the problem right there. There wasn't any new information. It was the repeat of the same information. And that just made people more and more frustrated because, okay, fine, you're telling me this information, but I already know this. What new information do you have? And there was also the communication with the families as well of the victims, of those on board. And there was not really cohesive communication with them. So they themselves were left thinking, you know, imagine if it's your family members, you're left not knowing what on earth happened, and you're just not getting the information that you want and need. So they got really frustrated, didn't they, Azif?
They did. But then again, I think we can't fully blame MAS or Putrajaya for not being able to know how to handle the issue. Not because it's unprecedented, but because the fact is, they themselves may not even have proper information to begin with, right? A disappearance. We have no information whatsoever. What happened to the plane until now? Whether it crashed to the sea, whether it disintegrated in midair, we don't really know. And I think as journalists, what we do is that we try to get information to pass to the public, but yet at the same time, so it's frustrations that come from all sides, right? Information that really nobody has their hands on. And people don't want to make assumptions of the issue, so we'd rather not say things which are unconfirmed to begin with.
No, but the problem also is that because there is so little information that is out there, people start speculating in order to fill the gaps, and that's where you've get all this misinformation being spread as well.
Mm-hmm. And it didn't help that in the first part of the press conferences, there was so many misinformation to begin with. We couldn't agree on what the time was of the last contact. We couldn't agree on which part of the sea to start looking. You guys remember, first we wanted to look at another part of the sea, and then we reverted back to the other part of the sea. So we wasted basically a whole week of that. So frustrations, anger, misinformation, clarification, it all builds up.
Okay, so how did you actually approach this episode, Azif?
For me, it was to basically tell a story, chronologically at least. So I began with the disappearance, tell the story from the start, and then get the players involved, help them to tell their stories. And so it was an exploration of the timeline, basically the timeline, the communication timeline between government and media, and at the end of the day, a wrapping up of really what the conclusion was. And at the end of the day, what we learned was that we are not really professional when it comes to crisis communications or management to begin with. And as with any media, when we lack information, we begin to speculate. Mm-hmm. But I think what I wanted to hit at the end of the day was to really focus on Hishamuddin Hussein, our defense minister, his statement on history with Judge as well. And this is what Krishnamurti and Jahar Basari had to say about it.
He was the best, you know, among all the government officials. And I think he did well because he had some training after the Lahad Datu fiasco with press conferences. He had some training by a local guy and a local journalist too. And the angles, the agendas, the lines of questioning, he handled them all very well by the media.
All throughout MH370 from day one till today, the government of Malaysia has been at pains to distance itself from any blame. When a minister says history will judge as well, he's obviously praising himself way ahead, 10, 20, 30 years from the incident. But, you know, a year on, I don't think history has judged Malaysia well in its handling of the situation. A plane is lost. The crucial few hours, we never did anything. And that is recorded in history. The first 1 week, nobody knew who was in charge. Everybody had their 15 seconds of fame. A week later, Hishamuddin took charge. And, you know, he did well because the guys who came on earlier did not do well. They couldn't speak English. They didn't know what to say. He's a minister. He had access to all kinds of information. I would judge him well based on that. But if you look at it in totality, and unfortunately we have the comparison with Indonesia with QZ8501, I'll say, you know, we didn't pass the test the first time. We didn't quite pass the test the second time too. And it's proven the third time when we had this massive floods in Kelantan that we really can't handle crisis.
And remember what Jahabas said in your show? He said that, are we being unnecessarily harsh to the Malaysian government and to MAS? I mean, because this is, I'm sorry to repeat this, Cheryl, it is unprecedented. And it's just proven that Malaysia, we can't really handle crisis, even though we have operating procedures already put in place. But when crisis happens, we break.
Unprecedented to Malaysia, but not unprecedented to the world.
Exactly.
So we could have learned from the Air France
disaster
to begin with, right? I mean, there are models out there that we can pick up, learn from crisis management. But for us, perhaps it was lack of preparation more than anything else.
Yep.
Okay, so let's move on to the next item on the agenda. So if there's one noticeable thing this year, it's definitely the rise of terrorism in the world. We can see that with the recent California shooting, the Paris attacks, ISIS conflict, which has been ongoing since end of last year, I think. Something closer to home, Thailand bombing, in fact. So we have a lot of cases of terror and a lot of theories behind the rise of it, right? So with the media being rampant in their reporting of this issue, there's also this idea that the word terrorism has been thrown around.
So media, that's us. So how do we handle these cases? So Azif spoke to Renee O'Day from Al Jazeera in our episode called Error in Terror. So Azif, what was the episode about?
That's right. So earlier this year, Al Jazeera released an internal circular, you know, cautioning their staff from using the word terrorist quite loosely, because I think the media nowadays, especially the Western media, tends to use this word very loosely and links it to Islam, right? When it comes to describing aggressors. And it's a loaded term. The word terrorist, implicitly, if you check the dictionary meaning at least, talks about the act of violence, aggression, that is linked with a political belief. And I think this undoubtedly has, since 9/11, created a negative perception towards Muslims worldwide.
Islamophobia, do you think it's on the rise again since 9/11?
I think it's always been there, and especially with ISIS nowadays, which emerged in the phrase last year, people worldwide are trying to hold Muslims accountable for the actions of an extremist view.
So why is Al Jazeera telling their journalists to stop using the word terrorist?
And in a day, I think it's about becoming a responsible media. It's about knowing that, look, certain words, yes, may describe certain things, but the context of the word itself is incredibly heavy. To use a word so much to a specific community, for example, I think we all know about this, is that when it comes to an Arabic person or a person from Asia or Middle East, you immediately ascribe the word terrorist to them. But when it's a white person who shoots up a cinema, for example, suddenly this person's insane. This person's mentally ill. So there are representatives in the media. And this is really what Al Jazeera is trying to explore, trying to really make nuance of.
Yeah, I think Western media usually uses the term mentally ill, deranged, when it comes to events such as, take the Charleston church shooter. He killed how many people in a black church? About nine people in a black church. And the media refrained from using the word that the guy was a terrorist. Instead, they said that he had mental issues.
Ah, okay, okay.
Like, I like when René Odé says that Islam, when you translate it, it means peace. Okay, not, there's no intent to carry out acts of violence. And labels, they've been so simplistic. They've just been thrown there for, I think, it's mostly to generate, to sell papers. I mean, papers need to make a revenue, right? People still need to get paid, but at what expense?
Yeah, but I think linguistically, there's also this jumping to shorthand and familiar terms so that it'll be easier for your audience to understand. So, and especially when you have cases where certain individuals are linked to terrorist groups, it's easier to label them terrorists as opposed to individual acts committed by certain individuals not linked to any party. I think that's the thing. Maybe that's maybe the thinking by media groups, right? Mm-hmm. In using the term terrorist.
And the issue of lumping everything together, this can be seen as, I don't know if you guys watched this documentary. It's produced and directed by a local Malaysian who now works at the New York International Times. It's called The Jihadi in Our Family. And she follows the this ustad in Kelantan or Terengganu, Azif, do you remember? He had a madrasah there.
Kedah.
In Kedah, yes. Kedah. And his name is Ustad Lotfi. And
so he went to Syria to fight against Bashar al-Assad. But then again, he didn't really join the IS, right? What he did was he joined one of the rebel groups fighting against Bashar al-Assad. But what our media did was simplistically to lump and claim that Lotfi himself joined IS, because the general perception and everyone's stereotype of these sort of things is that, oh, if you go to Syria, you're joining IS. If you go to the Middle East to fight a certain group, you are joining the Islamic State. But then again, that is very simplistic thinking, right? And the thing is, about the media, we weren't responsible in really being nuanced with how we described the act. That we shouldn't exactly say that Lotfi joined IS. We could have just said that Lotfi joined the rebels fighting against Bashar al-Assad, which is a big difference from joining the Islamic State.
So I like how Renee ends her story, because you asked her the final question, what can we do to water this down? And she suggested that media, us, we should really understand the definition of a word and when to use it. And for the others, for the public, and it starts at homes, it starts at towns, at schools, at community, to change people's minds about how certain words, about what they mean, as now jihad only means holding a gun, starting a war.
To educate people then. And in fact, we also did another story, which is Balancing Fact and Fear, where Aisha and I spoke to Dr. Greg Barton, who now heads the Global Islamic Politics Center at Deakin, Australia. Now, he thinks that the media should be more aware about its biasness and stick to reporting just facts. Wait for official statements and not sensationalize issues just to sell papers. You know, a lot of media organizations love to use all these clickbait titles. Yeah, not right. Mm-hmm. Not right.
And Australia, you've seen a change in their narrative in tackling terror-related issues with the new Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. When the shootings in Parramatta happened earlier this year, he was quick to not use the word terrorist, even though he received a lot of criticisms from the public and other MPs saying that you call it as it is, it's a shooting, it's terror. But he refrained from talking about it. And when investigations were done, then he said this is a terror-related event, but one person should not define the entire community. So he joined forces with the Grand Mufti of Australia and said, look, one extremist does not mean the whole community is bad.
Exactly. And I think just as a final note to what you mentioned earlier about Reni O'Day, what she said was in order to counter these narratives about Muslims being terrorists or a certain group being ascribed to a certain label, I think what's important is to also come up with counter-narratives, stories about Muslims doing good things, stories about perhaps a community which is viewed and frowned upon, to really have them to tell their own stories in order to counter this negative perception on them. And we've seen a lot of that since 9/11.
All right, now moving on to our final story of the day, Love, Freedom and Merdeka. I know for one that this episode remains really close to my heart. It was one of the most moving episodes that we've done this year.
Mm-hmm. And exactly, I mean, the word Merdeka itself, again, since we're talking about terminologies, different words mean differently to different people, different contexts, different communities. And the word Merdeka, I think, has been in the Malaysian consciousness for the past 58 years. But what exactly does it mean to us, right? I think what we did with this episode is really to explore Merdeka back down to its roots. Right in the beginning, when Tunku Abdul Rahman shouted the word Merdeka 7 times at Stadium Merdeka in 1957.
And I think this episode, you know, this year's Merdeka at least, came on the heels of the Bursar 4 rally. So it meant a lot more. The word Merdeka itself meant a lot more to the people. And
so you guys explored this episode with 3 different interviewees, as if you took on Tunku's granddaughter Sharifah Manjalara. Cheryl, you took on the media veteran PC Shivdas, and Hanif spoke to Kuke Kim,
which is a
famous historian. So Azif began the show talking to Manjalara, and what did she have to say? How does she remember Tunku?
I think that's the thing, right? Because she is Tunku's granddaughter. And in fact, I think if you speak to a lot of veteran politicians or diplomats who work closely around Tunku's time, they would describe him as a very fatherly man who was very loving, devil-may-care, free, and a fun person to be around. And this was shaped by his experience back in the UK and perhaps how he viewed Malaysians. Yes, you're from different races, but we can move together in unity. And this is the philosophy he based himself on when he wanted to reach for Malaya's independence, right? And that's an interesting thing. I think what we did was the thinking behind these 3 different people was to explore the foundations of the forming of Malaya, its independence, right? So we explored the personal, which is with Tunku's granddaughter. We explored the structural, which is the media coverage, and that, Cheryl, is what you did. And with Hanif, we explored the philosophical foundations of the country and who best we talked to by a historian, right? Cheryl, maybe you can share your experience with PC.
Well, first of all, PC Shivdas coming in and all that, it was someone who lived through Merdeka. He was a kid when the country was declared free, and he remembers it fondly and stuff. And he was like a, you know, a grandpa coming in, telling me stories of what was going on and stuff. And so we discussed Malaysia post-Merdeka and how the media had a role in helping to shape public opinion, and developmental journalism was used as a model in order to help with this. So the media was also used to support government efforts and aspirations, and it became the voice of the public.
So it's like basic principles, right? I mean, the word Merdeka, we couldn't exactly say it in every single sentence, but we translated it via the voice of the people, the voice of the government, and how the media reported it in order to shape perceptions. And because back then, newspapers, before the coming of online media anyway, newspapers were the voice of the people.
Yep.
It was also the voice of the government, the way in which government, as you can see, I think back then we saw a lot of developmental projects, and it was the media's duty to report these things in order to give people this sense of hope that yes, the government is doing something, we're moving towards a certain direction.
The sense of nationality,
exactly.
Right? Unity in diversity, that's what Manjalara said, that Tunku always likes to repeat to her. How about Kuke Kim, Hanif? Tell us about that. I love the bit where you interviewed the historian, and he kind of, my takeaway from that was, it reminded me what my role is as a Malaysian. So tell us about the interview. What did he say?
Yeah, it wouldn't do us justice to do an episode on Merdeka without talking to a historian, right? I mean, it's only natural to speak to Kuke Kim, one of the famous historians in this country. And it was a fun experience meeting him. It was very formal, I guess, the meet to interview him. But he puts forward this whole idea of how we need to remember our roots and understand that in order to move forward, we need to look back and find the right definition. And I have this clip that you talk about, Aisha, in which he defines the word democracy and what it means to Malaysian.
What does democracy mean? Democracy means government of the people, by the people, for the people. That means the people themselves were responsible for their own well-being. Of course, all the citizens in one country cannot come together and run the country. So they had to elect representatives to run the country on their behalf. But the people who are elected to run the country must always be responsible to the people as a whole. So when a politician says he is elected so he cannot be touched, rubbish. When he is elected by the people who elected him have every right to determine his future. And he must serve them. He must do what they want him to do. But in our country, very often the people don't understand that. They think the politicians are ruling. The politicians are not ruling. They are running the administration on behalf of the people. The people are ruling. They must obey the people. But our people don't understand that they obey the people whom they elect, you see. As I said, a lot has to do with education. So education, in our education system, unfortunately, does not explain things. And therefore, the people remain very confused. They don't know where they stand, and they don't know what is happening in the country. They don't know what is right and what is wrong from the legal point of view. Okay. They don't.
And that's the interesting thing about talking to historians, right? What we realize is that historians remind us of our roots. In fact, I think now because Malaysia has gone through about 3 generations, the most of us in this country, we seem to have a disconnect between what happened in the past or really understand in the past. In fact, when we look back at our constitution, how many of us really understand what's written in that document? We don't. We make assumptions based on a certain narrative which we think is true, but
in certain narrative that we are told, and it's not really the exact fact of what happened and stuff.
And the idea is really to explore back our origins, understand the philosophical foundations of why we even started in the first place.
So that was the one thing that was really, you know, since we're talking about the history and all that, listening to that, and again, like I said, it was at the time of the Bursay 4 rally, so sentiments were high, and I think it made you think back, and it made you think, this is my country, I want it to be the best it can be, and that was that sentiment. So this episode, it I bawled my eyes out listening
Me
to it.
Me too. Yeah.
The production value, the music that was chosen, as if you did a very good job putting this episode together.
Mm-hmm. Just in case you guys don't know, I'm also the editor for the show as well.
Yes, we give him everything.
And that's the thing, right? At the end of the day, this show was about exploring how far have we gone since 1957.
Was part of our Merdeka Day programming throughout the whole station. So the whole station did a lot of other programs as well that I think you guys should check out.
It's right on our website.
To answer your question, how far we've gone, Azif, I think we've gone okay, but we can definitely improve.
Definitely.
Better. Definitely.
Hmm. And I think this is why we ended the show with really reminding ourselves of the very moment when Tunku declared ourselves Merdeka. If you want to listen to the clip, here it is. It's been 58 years since we achieved independence, or become a nation state, as some believe we are.
So what does it mean to be Malaysians and to be independent?
How have we come to understand and live up to the term Merdeka? What does it mean today?
The answer lies in how we decide the fate of our nation. How do we move forward and define for ourselves what we want to be?
What we together want to be.
58 years on and forward.
Merdeka.
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 Akan kekal menjadi sebuah negara demokrasi yang merdeka dan yang berdaulat serta berdasarkan kepada kebebasan dan keadilan dan mengekalkan keamanan di antara segala kala bangsa. Kuala Lumpur, 31 hari bulan Ogos tahun 57.
This morning's show was produced by Cheryl Kaur, Hanif Baharuddin, Aisha Tajuddin, and myself, Azif Azuddin. It's been 2015, a great year, a year of many lessons to learn from, especially from the media, so...
I hope it's been food for thought, and remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
This is, in case you missed it, BFM 89.9,
the business station. Hanif, Hanif!
Oh, I have to say.
Yeah. Okay.
I thought... Three's a crowd, right? Okay, come on, let's do it again.
Three's a crowd, four's a Hanif, is it?
No, four's like total meltdown. Okay, but let's go.
This is, in case you missed it, BFM 89.9,
the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.